You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, WMUK's Gordon Evans talks with University of Toronto professor Doris Bergen. The author of War and Genocide, A Concise History of the Holocaust, speaks tonight at Kalamazoo College. But first, we'll discuss another historical event, this one in the United States that marks its 25th anniversary next year. It's when in 1991, Anita Hill, a young law professor, sparked public awareness about sexual harassment in the workplace after her graphic testimony accusing then U.S. Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas of a long list of inappropriate behavior. Thomas had once been her supervisor. Anita Hill was both criticized and praised at the time. At its worst, there were death threats, and her university tried to get rid of her. Now, age 58, Hill mostly gets an altogether different reception. At an appearance in Kalamazoo earlier this week, the crowd gave her a standing ovation as she walked onto the stage to deliver a talk about gender violence as part of Western Michigan University's Raise Your Voice speaker series. Hill teaches social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University in the Boston area. I had a chance to sit down with Hill immediately after she spoke for an exclusive interview on a broad range of topics. In the Boston Globe last year, you said that sexual harassment and assaults in the military and on college campuses shows that we can no longer wait for elected officials for solutions. You said it's time to start the conversation again. What did you mean by that?
Especially when we talk about sexual assault in the military, there had been proposals to change the system in the military that was before the Senate. They couldn't decide. They couldn't decide whether to remove the issues from the chain of command. And the assaults we know are real. They're dangerous, and they continue. And so we can't just simply assume that because they know about them that things are going to be done differently. We've got to make sure that we hold them accountable. And that means that if they don't respond appropriately, that we vote elsewhere.
Speaking of elected officials, over the weekend, big announcement. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced her candidacy for the U.S. presidency. But putting aside whether or not you'd vote for her, what effect do you think having a woman in the White House in that kind of conversation that you're talking about that needs to be revisited about sexual harassment and other gender issues, in which areas, if any, do you envision progress being made at all? Do you think it's going to make a difference?
I think that it can make a difference. I think it depends on what the people she puts in place make as their priorities. And I hope what we won't get is an effort for us to say, put extra pressure on her to be neutral. And I think that has happened with our current president, who has been encouraged to be race neutral and not pay attention to race issues. So I'm hoping that we are beyond that, that we will not, if a woman is in the White House, whether it's Hillary Clinton or someone else, that we will not demand that she be gender neutral and that we attend to many of the gender issues that are ongoing and that are hampering all of us, the progress that we're all hoping to make.
I know in your book, Reimagining Equality, you outline the evolution of racial discrimination in the more sophisticated forms. It's gone from slavery to segregation to redlining to gender and racial bias in lending. But it seems that since your case in terms of, let's talk about sexual harassment in the workplace, while it has changed the conversation in terms of maybe people don't probably overtly do that like they used to, is it going into different forms in the workplace?
I think two things are happening. Uh-huh. One, I do think that it's been institutionalized, that it's been built into our evaluation systems. Mm. It's been built in ways gender discrimination and inequities are being built in ways that we're not accounting for. For example, when women are evaluated and told, oh, you must be softer, or you must be develop a way to be more collegial. And in some ways, we don't hold men accountable in the same ways. We're not telling men they should be softer. And so an evaluation process then is institutionalizing our bias. I think in those situations where we have heard that in some workplaces, women are excluded from activities, women are still in workplaces where men routinely talk about pornography and strip clubs. We are in situations where we know that there are cultures and climates that prevent women from being equal and making progress. And then you add on to that the way they get overlapped and built into evaluation structures. That's one thing that we're dealing with, things that are changing in the workplace that are keeping us from preventing discrimination and harassment. The other thing, and law professor Catherine McKinnon talks about this, is that procedurally, the rules are really limiting the way harassment is defined and who has responsibility for it. And so this goes back to some of the Supreme Court cases, fighting on two fronts. One, they institutionalize gender bias, and then on the courts that are, seem to be hardening to these claims through the processes and some of the standards that have been elevated in terms of proving sexual harassment.
We talk next about gender pay equity, starting off the conversation with a new approach being used by Ellen Pao, interim CEO of Reddit, a social networking and news website. Pao has banned salary negotiations from the hiring process at her company, saying men tend to be tougher negotiators. I asked Hill if she supports the move.
Well, I think one of the things that it is true that women are coming in at lower salaries. I'm not sure banning salary negotiations will do it. I think that in many cases, the higher pays are not necessarily even negotiated pays. We know from information that's gathered on unconscious bias that men are best awarded by their supervisors higher pay. If you're looking at resumes that are all the same, that ones that are men, even though the women may have the same training, the same attributes, the same experiences, the men and women evaluating those resumes award men more money than they do the same situated women. So I don't know that the negotiating, that all of the disparities come through negotiations.
What's going to help with pay equity?
I asked that question once to Senator Kennedy. He was at an event at Brandeis University, and I said, ask him two things. I said, the country assumes that we can't do anything about, or we haven't done anything about unemployment rates higher for black and brown men, and we haven't tackled the issue for women of pay equity. And he said to me, and I think this is true, that we have to have a Secretary of Labor whose top priority is eliminating pay disparity and whose top priority, or second, or somewhere on the same level, is their attention to the higher unemployment rate in communities of color. And so that has got to happen. It has to be the priority of an official who is appointed by a president who will back him.
Anita Hill often speaks with young girls and college students, keenly aware that they were not born during the time that she testified before the Senate judiciary hearings. She wants to make sure that this generation is aware of sexual harassment. One way that she's doing that is through a documentary that was released last year. But on the horizon is a film by HBO on her life. She's not involved with this film, but it does star a very popular African-American actress, Kerry Washington, the star of hit TV drama Scandal. I was reading in the Hollywood Reporter, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but last month it was announced that an HBO film is coming out called Confirmation. And the Scandal actress, Kerry Washington, is supposed to be playing you. All right, do you know who Kerry Washington is?
It's kind of hard not to know who Kerry Washington is, isn't it?
And one, were you aware of this film, and are you going to be involved with it? And what do you think of her playing you?
Well, I was aware of it. And, of course, I'm more aware of it, mostly from the stories. You know, I'm interested in seeing how it comes out. Yeah, it's an important subject. And I grew up at a different time, but I teach young people. They watch Scandal. They'll watch Kerry Washington. They'll learn from the film if it's done right and it's done well. And HBO has a good reputation. And I'm excited to see where this can take another generation of viewers.
Speaking of this next generation, some of the issues that you talked about in your talk tonight is you were talking about cyberstalking and bullying and shaming in public places and things that are being done that is making victims want to be silent. Talk a little bit about that, and is that something that concerns you?
It absolutely does concern me. I was fortunate that in 1991, we hardly had much email, but I got the negative messages in the forms of letters and phone calls. I think the threat that the internet offers is different in a way because there's a protection and an anonymity. You don't know where they're coming from, and you don't know how widespread the shaming and the name calling gets. You don't know who might be reading about you, reading things that are not true about you. So I think it is a growing problem. It's a different problem. I think it's especially a hard problem for young people who spend a lot of time and place a lot of credibility on social media. It defines in many ways their social lives. And I think it is a real threat. Some of the more vicious stuff that happens when women complain about it, women in the industries who are in the tech industry who complain, then get cyber-bullied. I think it's a growing threat, and there's got to be some kind of recourse.
During your presentation, you talked a lot about, if I'm understanding correctly, that the handling of sexual assault complaints on college campuses, it seems like the burden of proof is moving toward, like, a criminal area?
Well, that's been an effort to say, a lot of people are saying, campuses shouldn't even be hearing these. Well, as a criminal matter, campuses shouldn't be hearing them. But as a civil rights matter, campuses have a responsibility to hear them. It doesn't remove the responsibility of the criminal justice system to address them.
What then would you want the consequences to be for those that are found to have committed these sexual assaults? You were referencing an individual who was said to write a letter of apology.
I think in the worst cases, I mean, there are different levels of sexual assault, but I think in the worst cases, people should be expelled. The community has to decide what their standards of behavior are. We expel students for cheating. We expel students for stealing other students' property. And sexual assault is certainly serious. It's an offense to the individual who is assaulted, but also to the community and the community standards. And it's a violation of rights.
And do you think, though, criminal charges should also be brought in certain cases?
Oh, absolutely. One is not the end of the criminal justice process. The criminal justice process should act in ways more responsibly than it has, because we know how difficult it is in a criminal justice system to get a prosecution for sexual assault.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I am just so delighted to meet you.
Good to meet you. Well, thank you. And thanks for your question.
We've been hearing from Anita Hill. Next year is the 25th anniversary of her testimony against U.S. Supreme Court Justice nominee Clarence Thomas that helped change laws and thinking regarding sexual harassment in the workplace. For more information about this story, visit our webpage at WMUK.org. For WMUK's West Southwest, I'm Earlene McMichael.
This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 70 years ago this month, the world began to learn much greater detail about the atrocities committed in Nazi Germany as Allied forces liberated several concentration camps. Doris Bergen has extensively studied and written about the Holocaust. The University of Toronto professor is the author of several books, including War and Genocide, A Concise History of the Holocaust. Bergen will speak tonight at Kalamazoo College. Her address is called Holocaust or Genocide, Uniqueness and Universality. Doris Bergen, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I want to begin by asking you about the title of this address, because it says Holocaust or Genocide, there's a question mark. Is there a meaningful difference between the idea of Holocaust and genocide?
Well, I think the term genocide is really a broader term, right? That's used to describe many cases of extreme violence. We talk about the Armenian genocide, marking, of course, 100 years since it began in 1915, since it occurred. So genocide is a broader term. Holocaust refers specifically to Nazi German programs of mass killing during World War II. But there, what I wanted to raise with that title and that question mark is the issue of comparison. You know, many people wonder, is it helpful to compare the Holocaust with other genocides? What do we learn from comparing? So that's what I'm really trying to get at there. How do we think about different cases of extreme violence in relation to each other?
And in some cases, do people not want to make a comparison because they want to set the Holocaust off by itself? It's such a horrible thing that you can't compare it to something else. Is that the idea what you're getting at there, that we don't want to compare those two things, or we may be reluctant to?
Sometimes people are reluctant to compare them. Sometimes comparisons can be misused as a kind of one-upmanship, right, to sort of have a competition or a hierarchy of suffering. What I'm trying to show and what I'm going to emphasize in my talk is that, in fact, comparisons are extremely valuable. They can also be, while they are necessary, they can be a very powerful way to help people relate and connect with events that can seem very long ago and far away.
You begin the book War and Genocide by saying that in order for a house to burn down, there have to be preconditions. And you say that's also true for the Holocaust. So give us an idea, what were those preconditions that were already in place that then eventually helped create the Holocaust?
Well, the reason I use that analogy of a house on fire is I'm trying to show conditions that were in place and some that were new. Because what I say there is for a building to burn down, you really need three things. You need that dry timber. That's what I think of as maybe pre-existing ideologies, anti-Semitism, hatred, prejudices, social tensions. Those are things that make timber dry and combustible. But it's not going to start burning unless someone lights a match, the spark. And that I refer to as the role of the leadership. In the case of the Holocaust, Hitler, the Nazi power in Germany, but other genocides too. They never are simply a spontaneous eruption. There's somebody who, let's say, lights the match. And then the third condition that I bring up there is what I call the favorable weather. You know, if some building is burning and it starts raining, it's not going to keep burning. But if you have a kind of dry conditions, maybe a bit of a light wind that fans the flames, that's going to take that combustible timber, that spark, and turn it into a conflagration. And there, what I was thinking of is the surrounding conditions of war. War is often a terrible facilitator for extreme violence. It can provide the kind of, conducive circumstances. So that's what I was thinking of. Preconditions, those are often, like I say, ideological, social, you know, tensions, pre-existing tensions within a society. But you still need that leadership to galvanize those, to mobilize them. And you need the conditions that allow them to turn from kind of simmering, you know, discontent or, you know, ongoing, maybe low-level violence to full-blown genocide.
You also say in your book that the Holocaust was not uniquely German. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean, first of all, is if you think about, you know, one of the really crucial preconditions in isolating Jews as a major target was, of course, anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, hatred of Jews, it was by no means, you know, a particularly German or uniquely German phenomenon. There's important elements of anti-Jewish thought built into Christianity, for instance. There's also 19th century, you know, racial notions that easily, you know, spread from place to place, eugenic ideas. You got to remember the first targets of mass killing in Nazi Germany were not Jews, but people with disabilities. And so those, you know, notions of, well, you know, who was to be considered a useless eater and so on, these things were very widespread. You had eugenics movements in North America, in other parts of Europe. You had extreme violence in European colonial systems, racism, social Darwinism. None of these things stopped at the borders of Germany. So there I was talking about a whole sort of complex of ideas that could be mobilized and that indeed had pretty wide traction.
The final chapter of your book is called Legacies of Atrocity. What are those legacies of atrocity in the Holocaust as we look back now 70 years into the past when World War II came to an end?
Boy, that is a really hard question to answer briefly. So let me see what I can say to that. Well, the first thing I guess I'm going to say is it's not as easy as we like to think. You know, often people say, what are the lessons? There's not necessarily such obvious lessons, but I guess a couple things that I'd point to as legacies is, first of all, to say, you know, one of the key things easily forgotten, big, huge outcome of the Holocaust is a terrible, terrible loss. You know, we tend to talk now, and of course it makes sense, about survivors, about triumph and resilience, but you have to think about what Europe was like in the spring of 1945. You know, people who had no idea whether anyone but them from their family had survived, even whether their entire community was left, people who didn't know, could they go home? What was home? People who, not just Jews, but others too, you know, there were millions of forced workers, Poles, Ukrainians, you know, French and other forced workers who at the end of the war found themselves in Germany, newly occupied Germany, massive numbers of displaced persons, you know, people who, yeah, had nowhere to go, no one to turn to, people who'd lost their children. Easily forget about this, right? We think about orphans, very heart-wrenching situation of orphans. But think about the other side of that, you know, a mother or a father whose children were killed or who had no idea where those children were. So that incredible sort of loss. And to look back and think, how did people try to rebuild functioning societies? You know, it's easy to look at all the different sort of failures, but it's also quite astonishing to think in 70 years, the kinds of families, communities, societies, you know, regimes, governments, that people somehow managed to put together. So that, both a legacy of loss and then intertwined with it, a kind of, yeah, I don't know, resourcefulness or resilience. It's quite astonishing. And of course, there are many other, you know, concrete things. We think about issues of justice. You know, most people have heard about the Nuremberg trials. You think about, you know, the importance of trying to bring some kind of justice to, you know, a world so torn apart. And there's also smaller ways where, for instance, you know, the Soviets, it's easily forgotten, often had commissions like created just on the ground trying to deal with, you know, collaboration with crimes committed in the areas that they liberated. And, you know, we easily forget this thinking about Allied liberation. You mentioned this in, you know, the spring of 1945. You know, the Red Army, the Soviet Army, they were allies too, right? They liberated major camps and killing centers. Auschwitz was liberated in January 1945 by the Soviets, Majdanek, months earlier. So they came across that evidence of, you know, mass killing much before the Western Allies did. So you have, you know, the attempt to kind of come to terms with what does it mean to do justice? You know, not only to punish, but to kind of make possible creations of viable societies. You can't punish everybody. So I think that's another legacy, very, very important. And there were efforts before World War II as well, you know, to have some sorts of international justice, post-war justice, but you see it on a huge scale there.
So World War II is an event which has been the subject of countless books, many movies. There are many people who have written about it, spoken about it, studied it. When you write about it, or when you come and speak about it at a place like Kalamazoo College, is there a certain area where you think you really dwell on? Is there a certain misconception or a myth that you want to clear up? Or is there a certain period of history there that you want to fill in the details on when you talk about World War II?
This is a great question. I hope I can do justice to it with an answer. You know, the thing is that I have a number of things that I really, really care about. One of them is I really want to emphasize the way in which World War II and the Holocaust were global events, not limited to Germany, not limited to Europe, you know, that they really had repercussions all over the world. And I mean, there's so many examples, but I'll just give you, you know, one kind of obvious one. You know that something like 18,000 Central European Jews, mostly from Germany, from Austria, survived the war in Shanghai. We don't usually think of Shanghai as a place linked to the Holocaust. It's enormously important. It's just one example. So I really try to emphasize the global dimensions of the Holocaust and of the war itself. I think that's crucial. The other thing that I think is really important to emphasize is, I guess, what I would call the kind of step-by-step nature of events. You know, often people ask, how did it happen? You know, how could such terrible things happen? A great scholar of the Holocaust, Raoul Hilberg, used to answer that question, and I like to borrow his answer, step by step. You know, you have 6 years of peacetime in Nazi Germany before the war, preparation, you know, of attacks on Germany's neighbors, of attacks against certain elements of the population. And this idea of chronology, that things happened step by step, I think it's really important both to understand those events and to understand our own world. In other words, it's not that things are inevitable. You can't always tell where those steps are leading. You know, I'm not saying it makes the future predictable at all. If anything, the opposite. But you see the kind of linkages, if you know what I mean, between actions, decisions, unforeseen consequences, often in quite different places. The complexity, I guess, is what I would call it, the complexity of human history. Difficult, complicated events have complicated causes.
Doris Bergen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Doris Bergen is a professor at the University of Toronto and the author of War and Genocide, A Concise History of the Holocaust. She will speak tonight at Kalamazoo College. More details on Doris Bergen's address this evening and a longer version of this interview can be found at WMUK.org. Southwest can be heard twice a week on WMUK. It airs at 9:30 Monday and Thursday mornings, with a rebroadcast at 3:30 in the afternoon on both days. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.